Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I try to open up my senses more. So when I go for a walk, if I'm on, obviously, the Hampstead Heath or Highgate Woods, because it's near me, I open up my ears a bit more. I start listening and questioning what I'm hearing.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Balancing Acts. In this conversation, I talk to the host of the podcast Into the Wild, Ryan Dalton. Perfect. Hello, I'm Steve Whiteley and welcome to Balancing Acts, a series of conversations with an array of creatives. We talk about their journey, the struggles they faced whilst progressing their career, strategies they use to unlock their creativity, how they balance their career with their personal lives, what impact this has had on their mental health, and lots more. So Ryan is a former stand-up comedian. He was performing for, I think, around 7 or so years. He also ran his own nights to Comedy Wire based in Surbiton, Surrey, Bracknell and Berkshire. Performed at a couple of his own nights. And we'd often see each other at gigs. And as we touch upon in the podcast, out and about in Hampstead Heath, wherein Ryan was dog walking, because he also has a dog walking business. However, Ryan had also been running his own podcast. And then when the pandemic hit, he decided to pivot slightly and interview personalities and experts in the wildlife and nature world. And now Ryan is solely focusing on that. So it's really interesting talking to him about that journey. We take a deep dive into some of the subject matters covered in the podcast and how, as a result of Into the Wild, Ryan is fronting and creating a film about trophy hunting in Namibia. We get into that and loads more. It's not an area that's really been touched upon in the podcast, so very curious to find out more from Ryan and also how he's transitioned from stand-up comedy to the podcast. On a separate note, there's something I want to share with you guys. When you hear the podcast, you hear the finished product, and that may sound slick because, you know, it's edited and put together, etc. But I would love to invite you to be a fly on the wall when I'm recording some of these intros. Sometimes I have to redo them like 20 times because I stumble on words, etc. And I'm just like cracking up, imagining people just watching me say the same lines over and over again, like a broken record. Maybe it's funnier in my head than it would be just observing it. I mean, observing it, you'd probably just be like, come on, man, get your shit together. But anyway, that's my share for you, just to let you know the struggles that I go through when creating this podcast. And if you haven't already, please do subscribe and rate and review it on Apple. That would be much appreciated. Tell your friends, share the love. Mikasa, Sukasa. Doesn't even make sense, but we'll go with it. And now, without further ado, over to Ryan. Perfect. It's great to see you, because like we were just saying before we started, the last time we saw each other was on Hampstead Heath and you were dog walking.
Yes, yeah, as always.
And that was pre-pandemic.
Do you know what, Steve? I can't fucking remember anymore.
To be honest, it's a bit of an inane question. It doesn't really matter, does it? I mean,
that's just the last time we saw each other.
Yeah, it's just the last time we saw each other.
Could have been last week, to be honest,
yeah.
Mate.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, during this whole last couple of years, obviously everything's changed and people end up trying different things, and then, you know, as a matter of, well, really out of necessity. You know, because of what you were doing before, was you were doing a lot of stand-up, you were running your own nights.
Yeah.
That was keeping you very busy. And now you're having to sort of, I guess, start again, not start from scratch, but like, what was your thinking during that period of time when you couldn't do stand-up? we'll get on obviously to the podcast, but were you straight away thinking, right, I need to find another sort of avenue to channel my creative energy?
Yeah, it was. I think everyone felt that. I think everyone I spoke to certainly felt that. I definitely, I don't get me wrong. There was 2 or 3 weeks where you're like, oh, I've been waiting for this. Cause you can't really, it's very hard to take a break from anything creative really, because it's so opportunistic. Do you know what I mean? It's like waiting for those chances to come up. So you could book a holiday and then suddenly, I don't know, the Glee Club asks you to do a weekend in that, and then that's fucked, it's gone. So it's so hard to be able to take that break. So I think for me at first, I was like, oh, this is going to be sick. Let's rest up for a bit and recharge your batteries. The other thing is I actually went into 2020 going for stand-up comedy, going, right, this is the last year I'm going to really push it. And if I don't progress, and I mean, I'm not saying that like from a TV and industry level, just from if I don't progress, be able to make that level of cash from it, then I'll step away.
Okay. How long have you been performing up to that point?
7 years, I think.
Okay, so you've been going for a while.
Yeah, I mean, if you take out the years, I mean, properly, probably four and a half, really going for it, like doing like, you know, I guess doing it being full freelance, so, you know, you could give a lot more time to it, not having a job on the side that working for anyone else. But so I was really like keen to kind of push into that, and then COVID happened and I was like, oh fuck, okay, well that's that plan buggered. So I was like, well, I guess the next thing I could do is see how I feel not doing it for a while. Like, it kind of would answer that question that you can only get an answer to by not doing stand-up. So I just thought I'd see how I feel. And then, like you said, the creative outlet is still, I don't think that ever goes away. So you're like, I need to be doing something. So that's we won't talk about that now, but that's where the podcast came up really.
Yeah. And did you have like in the back of your mind, because I, you know, you've always been obviously a wildlife enthusiast. Did you have that idea in the back of your mind prior to COVID, or was it simply COVID happened, you had time on your hands and you thought, you know what, I'm very passionate about wildlife and nature, I'm going to start a podcast about it?
It was two things, because I was already doing the podcast before COVID, but it was a lot more like a bit QI style, where I would sit with a couple of comedians, we'd talk about three animals kind of thing, and we'd just I'd go into depth about them. But that was so much fucking work, as in it was so much pressure on me to know everything, and I'm a bit of a generalist with nature anyway, but it was so hard to do. So it honestly took up so much time, Steve. It was like to the point I was like, this isn't worth doing. And then when lockdown happened, when we went into it, I kind of sat down on an afternoon, just pen and paper. I thought, well, maybe this is a good time to restructure the podcast and make it work a bit better. And then I suddenly, like, loads of people were saying, like, oh, everyone's stuck at home bored. Every TV show you put on, going, let's film this celebrity and see what they're not doing in their house. So I was like, is that literally what everyone's doing? So that's where I went on Twitter and just DM'd Steve Backshall, the BBC Wildlife presenter, and said, do you want to have a chat about nature on the phone? I'd love to have you on. And he just said yes. And I went, grand. So then 2 days later, we were recording. We had a half an hour chat on the phone. I recorded it on loudspeaker. It was so amateur. But that was that was the first episode, or the second episode, I think. And then it got a lot of shares and got a lot of listens. And then I realized when I compared that to the old episodes I was doing, the comedy style, I was like, actually, I'm tapping into the niche here. That there's a better niche where people want nature chat that's laid back. They don't want a comedy podcast with comedians talking about nature, like that, because it's very, that's too, I don't know, not what the wildlife world wants. So I suddenly started to realize there's all these amazing people in the nature industry that are on Twitter, on social media, science communicators, and they're all got so much to say. So I was like, I could have a chat with them. And that's how that kind of started. So yeah, it was a bit of a restructure really, I guess, that just blew up.
That's super interesting. And how much of your time now do you spend on the podcast? Because like it's edited very professionally. Like I was, you know, I did a bit of a deep dive into some.
My editor's going to love you for that.
Is it? Yeah, give him a little plug. But no, but not just that, you know, you've got like, you keep the social media up to date. Obviously, I know that's sort of like, granted, that's what you do with the podcast editor. But I just means like, you clearly put a lot of time and effort into running it.
Yeah, I think when I first started it and it started getting, I think the first 5 episodes were going really well. And John Maher, a comedian, said to me, he went, do it weekly. And I was like, really? He went, do it weekly. He said, if you don't do that weekly, it will drop off and you won't keep it up. And I was like, oh yeah, that's a good point. So I committed, even in the lockdown, we had to go and live on my girlfriend's narrow boat in London because there was an issue in our house. So myself, my girlfriend, and then
you
my housemate
were living.
Boat. These things happen to me, Steve.
Ryan is a very tall man, by the way, if you don't know. And he was living in a narrow boat.
I lived in it. I didn't stand up in it.
So, okay, but that's even harder then. So what, you're just sort of like hunched down?
Leaning everywhere. Yeah. A lot of leaning. But it was also bliss weather, do you know what I mean? Do you remember the first lockdown?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
that
was nice.
Degrees every day.
Okay,
it was nice.
Fine.
So it was all right. We could stand outside. But even then, I was like, well, I can't not do the podcast. So I was recording them on the boat. Just I had all my stuff with me. And
that's fun.
Yeah, it was good fun. And I was committed to doing it. I wanted to do it and stuff. And it kind of, at the beginning, it was a lot of work because I was editing it myself. So it would take, from recording an episode, let's say that's an hour and a half. And then you're editing, you're spending 3 or 4 days on it, a couple of hours at a time. And then you're tweeting it and then you're keeping up the promo for it. And then I think, when was it? Maybe a year ago, this wonderful man called Oscar, my knight in editing armor, just messaged me and was like, I'm a wildlife guy. I love the podcast. I've just finished university. I'd love to edit your podcast for you for a bit of cash. And at that point, I had a sponsor in that was paying me. And I thought, well, I don't need all that money. And if it's going to save all my time. So now I record them, send him everything, and he sends it to me and it's bash done. Great. And I just tweet it. So now the workload is massively down, which is great. So much fun. Yeah. Now I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, it's a grind.
What about you? Do you find it hard?
Dude,
do you do it all yourself?
Yeah, no, I have an editor as well, but I'm not as consistent as you. I took like a 4 month break. And then
I had a four month break.
And so I've just got back. I've done like this is like the fifth episode after an interim period. What happened was is I got hit by a car in April, and then I had a bit.
Wait, pause. What? you can't just fucking throw that out.
I got into a fight with a car after a couple of drinks one night. I was cycling
and
back, and this Uber driver just did a sudden right turning, and I was just cycling across the road, and I ended up landing on his bonnet. But anyway, as a result of that, I had a bit of concussion. I didn't really realize I had concussion at the time. I was a little bit all over the place. But I took the time out, and my girlfriend and I decided to just up and leave. And we were working remotely from Madeira. And I just thought, you know what? I'm just going to take some time out for a bit. So I did, but now I'm doing it again. But what you say, I think, rings so true. And I think it's like true of any form of content creation. Consistency is key.
Yeah, it was the best advice I think I had prior to the podcast. And because it's so easy to go, I'll do it every 2 weeks, I'll do it a month, it doesn't matter. But then it's work, and it's hard because now we're up to like 79 episodes, and I'm like, is there still people to talk to? And then
of course there is, but it's
finding them. And it's then you've got that element of work of going, right, well, should I record them week on week, or should I just bash out 5 episodes in a week and keep them in the bank? So I've got them. So there's all that kind of crap and planning it, really. But then also, I guess, I think when the money side of it's coming in, you don't mind putting that workload in.
Yeah, of course. Of course, it goes from being a hobby to like a paid job, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, it's a good job. You enjoy it, surely.
Yeah, I absolutely love it. I love it. Like, you know, you get to have, you know, it's like you have conversations with all these people, and then some of them who you didn't know before then become friends. And also just the amount of information that you start to retain on different...
Oh, Christ on a bike, yeah.
Right? Yeah. I mean, I know if we had a pub quiz and the subject matter was nature and wildlife, I know who I'd want on my team.
Nature, wildlife, or 70s clothing, I'm fine.
Yeah.
Anything else, I'm fine.
Do you miss doing stand-up, or do you miss the whole scene?
Two questions.
Yeah, it is two questions. Do you miss performing stand-up?
Yes. Yeah. Do I miss the scene? No.
No, I don't mean the scene as in the scene, because it is scene-sterish, but I mean in terms of the whole, you know, the whole environment of doing a gig, and then you might chat shit with a comedian after, or, you know, that the social element to it.
No, Okay. I don't miss that bit. And that's that's no judgment on the people I was talking to at all. So I don't want anyone listening to that going, oh, he's a miserable cunt. But it's not that. It's more, I find the people I'm talking to now, you know, after a podcast, or like you said, you make friends through this. Like, you know, I've got nature friends now that I've never met, but I've known for nearly 2 years, which is insane, really. But I think...
What a great thing to say is that I've got nature friends.
They're all badgers. But they're wonderful people. They're so empathetic. They're so lovely. And you learn from them, which is I absolutely love. So I think those are the people I needed to be socializing and talking to more. And I think, and again, that is no judgment on the people doing stand-up, but we're all so different. Do you know what I mean? It was hard to find people you connected with in comedy, because you're all there for yourselves or for your specific voice and reason. I do miss being on stage. Like, you know, there's moments where someone will put a picture up of, you know, I don't know, the Comedy Store on a Friday night, or, you know, Top Secret Comedy Club. And I'm like, well, that looks banging. Do you know what I mean? And you know that's going to be good fun. But I don't miss it enough to go, I need to go back to it. But then also, I don't know, I guess, do you feel that door can never fully close, can it?
No, it's always like, it's always a jar, skill, isn't it? Yeah. Anytime you want
to. You don't lose it.
No.
Well, some people do.
Some people never had it. But
they never had it, mate. Can't lose what you didn't have.
Exactly. So I'm all right with that. I'm all right with that.
No, absolutely not. I won't let you say that in the podcast. But I don't know. I think doing the podcast is almost like doing stand-up for me when I'm doing the intro and stuff like that. It's a bit of a, I'm talking into a microphone, I'm performing. And it's led on to some exciting things that was almost stand-up. It's certainly presenting, so.
I wanted to talk to you about that because I was listening to, I really enjoyed the episode with, is it Tanya Esteban?
Yes. Yeah. Tanya. She's amazing.
I was drawn to that because this idea of, and I'm going to butcher the pronunciation, is Ikigai?
Ikigai. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. And I liked it because it kind of ties in with some of the themes on this podcast about trying to find a sense of balance. But do you want to can you explain a little bit about Ikigai and sort of that whole Japanese philosophy in terms of your conversation?
Yeah, do you know, because it was an interesting one, because I had no idea what it was going to be about. Tanya, I've been trying to book an episode with Tanya for ages, but she's very busy. She's an amazing wildlife filmmaker for BBC and stuff. And we finally sat down. She just made this short film called The Guardians of Ikigai. And she had spent it just before lockdown being in Japan and traveling around. And it's really focusing about the imperfections and celebrating them and kind of knowing. I mean, I think the one thing we have lost in the West is that connection with nature, but elsewhere in the world, they still have that connection and use that. And it kind of paves their, anything from their artwork to their writing, to their film, to their belief system, to the way they live and stuff. And it was really like following this is so long ago I had this chat, Steve. But this is what I mean with doing an episode every week. You forget shit.
Yeah, you do.
It was, so Tanya had made this film about some wildlife in Japan and then wanted this artist to do her spoken word over it. It's a beautiful film. It's only 15 minutes long, but it's there was a lot about talking about the imperfections, and rather than fearing them or closing them off, celebrating them as well, which was really nice.
Yeah. Yeah. And, yeah, in terms of immersing yourself in nature, a bit of forest bathing never goes amiss.
Yeah, have you done that?
Tried it once, and I don't know. I just laid down for a few minutes waiting for some epiphany to hit me, and it never did. So I got up and I carried on with my day.
Up, cracked on.
Yeah, I don't think I was doing it right. Sorry,
wild swimming or anything?
Big fan of that. I mean, Hampstead Heath is about as wild as it gets.
Okay, it's pretty wild.
I surf.
Do you surf?
Yeah, I really love surfing.
That's cool.
So
how do you think you were doing forest bathing wrong?
Well, I was doing it as part of a bike ride, actually. Me and my friend, we were bike riding, and then we just decided to, well, have you heard about this forest bathing thing, mate? He's like, yeah. Should we give it a go? What? Should we give it a go? What, you and me? Yeah, all right. All right. Don't tell anyone, yeah? No, that's not happening. We lied down and it was pleasant, but I'm sure it's the sort of thing you need to be spending a bit of time doing. You don't want to be in a rush. you're going out your way to do that as part of a process, right? Have you done it?
Yeah, it's. I don't think I sat down to do it, but I think it's something because I nature. This is going to sound a bit hippie. It doesn't matter, does it? It's who I am. But it, nature for me means so much that I think if I walked to a top of a hill and looked over the landscape, whether that was like ocean, sunset, sunrise, whatever, that for me is almost like that bathing. I don't have to try to do it. It just kind of happens. I'm immersed in it. So I enjoy it. And it's almost like a meditation for me, I think.
That's a great point. Yeah, that's very true. The reason why I mentioned that episode, because you were saying about how, you know, the podcast has created all these different, you know, opportunities and open doors for you.
Yeah.
I was curious to find out more. You mentioned it in that episode that you're making a film in Namibia. And
yeah, it's mad, isn't it?
Yeah. Tell me what's happening. How did that come about?
So if we had spoken 2 years ago and you said to me, Ryan, what do you think of trophy hunting in Africa? You know, American or Western people going out to shoot wildlife for money. I'd be like, oh, that's fucking sick. You know what I mean? I'd be like, nah, they need to ban that. That's horrible. And about 6 months into doing the podcast, I saw a thread on Twitter with someone was commenting on it that had already been on my podcast. And I was like, oh, I don't really get that. Blah, 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 blah. Ask a few questions. And we had a nice back and forth chat. And then he ended up DMing me going like, dude, this is a really big topic. You should probably cover it on the podcast. And I was like, really? And he was like, hey, so trophy hunting is so misunderstood and misrepresented in the media that I think it's something you could probably really have a good chat about. And he said, but do us a favor, don't talk about to a white Western person, talk to people in Africa. And I was like, yeah, well, how the hell am I going to do that? And he said, well, leave it with me. And he's a professor. He's a wonderful man. He's become a good friend of mine. He's Professor Adam Hart. Follow him on Twitter. He is absolutely incredible. Does great stuff for wildlife conservation. And he hooked me up for a Zoom chat to talk to a lady called Maxie Lewis, a guy called John Walima, and a lady called Lorna Dax, who all work at different stages for local governments or work with local people in Namibia. And they manage their trophy hunting. And it was basically a chance for me to sit down with these three people and say, like, sorry to be the white Western guy, but I'm going to ask some questions about trophy hunting. Like, why do you use it as a method of financial gain? How is it not affecting wildlife populations? How is it managed? Is it regulated? All these kind of questions. Or should we ban it? Stuff like that. And my eyes were just fucking opened so much to how much I didn't know about that. So how much I personally read about wildlife conservation. I was like, this is mad that in Western media, it's represented as this, you know, the reason why wildlife is struggling is because of trophy hunting. And it's the counter opposite. Wildlife is thriving in Namibia, like more so than any other country in Africa because of the way they utilize their wildlife to benefit not just the wildlife itself, but the local communities. Because I think one thing we forget a lot is that with wildlife conservation, we as a species, humans, are involved with that. We rely on this planet for everything, for food, for medicine, for, you know, mental health, everything. We rely on nature, and even more so in countries like Africa and Asia and South America, where they have a cultural history of depending on wildlife. And what Africa and especially Namibia have done is utilize their wildlife. So, you know, you've had the colonial past where British people or, you know, some Western European country has gone in and taken over. And then when they've left, kind of Namibia went, well, fuck it, we'll keep trophy hunting because it's making money. You know, we'll keep farming because that's making a bit of money. We'll keep ecotourism, like safaris. So all it is really is Africa has just decided to keep the things they want to keep and they're happy to keep and to make money from it. And so we had this amazing chat and I learned so much and I released the episode and Jesus Christ, Steve, did it get some backlash on Twitter. I was kind of prepared, but not prepared. But so that was kind of a couple of weeks of dealing with some animal rights activists saying that we had paid these people to talk, which is not true, and stuff like that. And then probably about 2-3 months on from that, releasing that episode, I said to Adam that I can't believe that people still don't believe people in Africa. Do you know what I mean? You're ignoring these people. Like, yeah, fair enough if you read an article and you don't believe it, but it's come from these people's mouths that have no reason to lie about this. And they're still being told they're wrong. And he said, yeah, it is mad. And he said, but, you know, hearing it's one thing. He said, but seeing it would be another. Maybe we should go out there and film something. And I went, yeah, okay. And then we thought, fuck it, let's try it. So we did a crowdfunder to support the podcast, and we got a bit from that. And then a kind of a sponsor organization that sponsored wildlife documentaries, but they have to involve the local community, got wind of our project. And they said, we would like to fully fund this for you to do it. So long story short, they are fully funding this. And
that's incredible.
In January next year, now Namibia has opened up its travel, we are going to Namibia for 2 weeks to meet with local communities in Namibia at seven different locations, but probably be more, 9 or 10. To basically sit down with them and me to get the chance to ask some more questions and just be like, let's find some more. But basically, see, what I'm trying to do is create something that people can't fucking argue with. Because right. It's mad that they don't believe, you know, we month in, month out, and rightly so, we have Black Lives Matter in the UK. You know, if people talk about Black Lives Matter, but as soon as we talk about Black Lives Matter in Africa, people don't give a shit. It's like, well, no, they're wrong. Or that's not true. And I think that's never, I've never sat well with that. And I think these with wildlife conservation, from how great Namibia are managing their wildlife and how poorly we're doing it over here in England, I think we've got stuff to learn from Africa. And I think we need to be listening to this. And you know, I'm not a fan of hunting. I mean, what, we're 25 minutes into the podcast, so it's important for me to now sound vegan. I've got to say it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
But I don't like hunting. I wouldn't do it, and I don't understand people that would want to do it for money. But the fact is, I'm not African, and I shouldn't decide what happens with African wildlife. They should be leading that way, not us.
So what's the deal then with the benefits of trophy hunting, and that, with obviously without any spoilers, because this is obviously going to be in your film. But in terms of what you discussed on your podcast, explaining it to a Luddite like me. I saw an episode, something, I don't know if it's the same thing, but I can't remember where it was. It was maybe somewhere in Canada where they released these wolves, which would almost been extinct. And then they brought them back into the wildlife. And as a result, it had this huge knock-on effect on the whole food chain ecosystem due to all these different impacts and implications that I won't even, you know, attempt to explain. But I watched that and that kind of made sense to me. That's obviously not trophy hunting, but it's sort of like a positive form of culling of some sort.
It's, I mean, that's probably an example of rewild or reintroduction of a species. So a species that have been lost.
Yeah.
And it's something like a wolf in that area would be like a keystone species. So
that's right. Yeah.
So when we say keystone species, yeah, it's more something that species itself can have so many knock-on effects to benefit the local area or local habitat. Or surrounding habitat, so it can bring stuff back, it can control prey species, so it can take down deer populations, which will help trees grow again, which will bring back mammals, birds, insects and stuff like that. So with trophy hunting, and I guess the two important things to say about this is hunting as a topic is so diverse. There is not one type of hunting. There is a way to hunt, shoot and go and kill an animal, duck. But that's not the process. The processes are different everywhere you go. Talking about trophy hunting specifically in Namibia, because again, it does work differently in different African countries and in America and Asia and places like that. And in this country, I will say England does have, and the UK has trophy hunting. And that is an important thing to make as well. We always think we're guilt-free and we're not. So what Africa is, or Namibia has done this amazing thing where they have conservancies, which are like almost like counties or towns or settlements in Namibia. And each conservancy will be given their species. This is what I've learned through doing the podcast. Well, they'll be given their species list for the year or for the next 3 years that they are allowed to sell permits for to hunt for people. So that might be, you might get giraffe, zebra, elephant, lion and hyena. Let's just say those are your five species. And on top of that, you'll be get told how many species, how many individuals of those five species you're allowed to hunt. So let's say for elephants, it might be three. Mm-hmm. So in 2 years, they're allowed to sell three permits to kill three elephants. And those elephants are, that they know which elephants they are. They're not just random elephants. They are specifically targeted elephants because they might be old bulls that are not reproducing anymore. They might be an animal that is not really in matriarch anywhere, so it's not really having an effect on the local populations, or it's not going to disturb much. Then a permit will be sold to someone for X amount. I'm not going to say numbers because I don't know how much they go for, but then the hunter will pay that, will go out there for X amount of time, let's say 4 weeks, to try and hunt this elephant. In Namibia, if they don't catch the elephant, because there are no fences in Namibia, nothing's fenced in, if they don't find the elephant, if they don't kill it, then it doesn't die, but the people still get the money. So the money still goes in. So there was a case in 2017 where 3 permits for elephants were sold, but only 1 was found. So the other 2 survived, and they would never go back on that rota to get hunted again. In that occasion, I'm not sure if that's changed in multiple locations. But so the main thing is what you've got there is it's incredibly regulated. It is not random hunting. It's not just go out with who you want, shoot what you want. It is incredibly monitored, regulated, and done to a very strong kind of database level. Then you've got the money side. So let's say someone, I don't want to drop a figure because I don't know how much this goes for. Let's just say 50 grand. Let's just say someone pays 50 grand. 25 of that will go to supporting the local community of where that conservancy was. So that might go into education, healthcare, might go into just food. Because that's the other thing, like, you know, trophy hunting, yeah, people shoot an elephant. That elephant is stripped bare in about 10, 15 minutes. There won't be anything left. And then the hunter will take what he wants as his trophy or her trophy. So it's actually feeding, because meat is very expensive in Africa. So it's, you know, it's sought after. So people, the meat is actually eaten as well. And then the other 25 grand would go to supporting wildlife conservation. So that could be putting good secure fencing up around farmland, so there's no conflict between people and animals. Could be putting fences up around schools so lions don't get into the ground. It could be providing water areas, salt licks for animals. It could be paying a ranger's wage to prevent illegal poaching. Okay. Or poaching. I don't think we need to say it's illegal. Just poaching. So it's all that thing. So it basically... it's one type of way that Africa uses its wildlife to get money for its people and its wildlife. The same with ecotourism, where people pay to get safaris, that money will get put back in. And the same with photo tourism, and the same with, I'm not sure what else. I think with tourism, that's probably it. But I think the big thing with trophy hunting is to know that taking it away, just going, ban that, which is a big, heavy thing in the UK. We like to say to them, ban trophy hunting. If you just ban it, there's no alternative to put in its place. And in areas like Kenya and in South Africa, where it has been banned, what you have seen is a high rise of poaching go up because people are still going to hunt.
Right.
They're still going to illegally sell the permits.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it's not regulated. And then you have people killing pregnant lions and stuff like that, which is more detriment to the wildlife itself. So the concern amongst conservationists, both in Africa and in the UK and some in America as well, is that taking something like this away without a valid alternative, whether we want it to happen or not, and a lot of conservationists obviously don't like the thought of it, but we'll have more killings for wildlife than if you keep trophy hunting. And also, like we said, you're taking away African people's money, which I don't think is very ethical.
So
that's interesting. Kind of, I mean, in a nutshell, yeah, it's really deep. It's, I mean, the word I use the most is nuanced. It's not a black and white issue. It's nuanced.
Well, that's something that's come. I find that comes up time and time again in different conversations I have on this podcast. You know, as partly the theme is balance, and that is so important, isn't it? And on all manner of subject matters, when we're living in such divisive times, and it's either or, it's this or it's that, and you know, to cut through the noise, you've got to be as outspoken as possible. Nuance sometimes gets forgotten in the process.
Quite often, and there's no room for nuance on Twitter.
I know. That's why I rarely tweet. Room. That's literally why I rarely tweet.
But that's the whole idea of it. Is and I think what I want to do is create this film where we can go out there, we can talk to local people, and then we can bring this back and say to people, "This is like, you know, watch this." Yeah. And I'm not saying change your mind, but just listen to these people that are seldomly listened to when we're trying to talk about this topic anywhere else.
And this is going to be a documentary.
Yeah, do you know what, Steve? I didn't want to call it a documentary at first because I was like, I've not studied to do filmmaking, and I feel like a bit of a twat going, I'm going to go make a film. It's like,
is that your imposter syndrome speaking?
It's like Joey Essex going, I'm going to give stand up a go. It's like, fuck off. Like, do you know what I mean? Like,
you're a valued member of that community now. You host a podcast, you speak to specialists each week.
Mm.
I mean, that means essentially you are a specialist of sort. You're a specialist of general nature and wildlife knowledge. And everyone starts...
I know,
but it's funny, isn't it? Like, everyone starts... You think about all the people, all the people in all the world.
I'm thinking about all the people.
Everyone starts from somewhere, though, no matter what field they're in.
Yeah.
And you just start, and you go through that period. It's like, I don't know about you, but when I first started off doing the podcast, anyway, I was like, who am I to do this? Who am I to talk about these?
Yeah, I did think that. There was a lot of that going, no one's going to fucking listen to this. Mm. And it turns out they're not listening to me, but they're listening to the guests. But Tanya, actually, I said that to Tanya, actually, off record. I said, like, hey, I felt a bit bad. And she went, why? You went, you're going out there filming something, putting it together and making a film. Why would you not call it a documentary? And I was like, yeah, because I'm an idiot. I'm British and I like to be self-critical.
but also from a creative perspective, it's inspiring. You've gone from doing stand-up comedy for X amount of years. You said to yourself, you're going to give it a certain period of time. Then obviously COVID happens. Mm. That kind of forces your arm a little bit. You then got all in on this new creative endeavor. And now as a result, you're going out to Namibia to make your own film.
It's mad. And I'm not just saying
I love it.
Like every time, like my mum or someone would be like, how's the plans with Namibia going? I'm like, I'm going to fucking Namibia. This is insane. Like, I've never gone to Africa. I've certainly never gone with the intention to create something. And I'm buzzing for it. And I'm excited to meet some people that I've already spoken via email with out there. And it's just insane. And I'm excited to learn. I'm excited to put it together. And I'm excited to present it back to people. Like I said, not to change minds, but just to add a level of that nuance in, I guess.
Be a great feeling when you end up, which I'm sure you will, screening it at sort of film festivals, relevant film festivals.
Oh, hell yeah.
And you see your film on the big screen. That's a buzz, man.
I'm going to try and make it as, it's got to stick to what the podcast is, and the podcast is laid back and it's.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so
that's your personality.
And I think that's important. Yeah, it's got to come out in it. So I'm looking forward to that. I'll be wearing, I know your listeners can't see my shirt, although it is quite loud, but wearing cowboy shirts and shit like that.
Your shirt's actually quite similar to the type of shirts that I used to wear when I was in character doing stand up.
Do you know what? That's what a review. I was going to say your shirt's quite quiet for you, but I guess I only really saw you.
That was
off the
that
stage,
was,
really.
Yeah, that was just his character. It was just my for listeners who haven't heard me talk about my stand-up character before, I performed as a spoken word artist under the name of Weisbaum, and he would always wear very loud shirts.
I mean, I like them.
I think as I get older, I'm trying to tone it down.
Why? Fashion.
I don't know. I just feel like, I don't know, you get to some point, no, come on, mate. You know, now that's enough's enough. Let's blend in. Perfect. Hello, sorry to interrupt in the middle of this insightful conversation, which I'm enjoying, I'm sure, just as much as you are. But I need to give you guys a little reminder. If you like this conversation, this episode, if you like balancing acts in general, then please do subscribe to us, rate and review us, because it makes the world of difference. And the more reviews we get, the more rates we get, the more people can discover the podcast and we can make it go viral, whatever that means. Okay, back to the chat. Also, I saw that you retweeted a tweet from someone that I very much admire, Hugo Tagholm. He's the, I think, he's like the CEO of the Surfers Against Sewage charity. He did a tweet about sea level rising and, you know, being ironic about it. Not in London. I went to a talk.
Yeah, he did. Was that the one of the London? It wasn't the Thames one, was it?
Yeah, it was the Thames one. Yeah, the picture.
It was the Thames barrier one, wasn't it? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I went to a talk of his about 6 years ago. He gave a talk about work that Surfers Against Sewage do. And like, it was so inspiring. And, you know, being a surfer, I thought to myself, I can't be enjoying the sea and not be doing anything to sort of contribute to protecting it.
Yeah.
And so I started donating after that, and I have done since. And, you know, I get their newsletters and also, and I just think what they do is so great. They, you know, these beach cleans, and I don't know about, I mean, do you find, having interviewed all these people, that in terms of thinking about what you can do to contribute, and you already are contributing by doing this podcast because you're getting information out there, but do you ever find there's a sense of overwhelm in terms of like, oh shit, the earth is going downhill. I don't know, you know, okay, I'm vegan. But, you know, in the grand scheme of things, what good is that going to do? Because I'm watching Earthshot, you know, and I come away from it. God.
I know.
Right, we need to do this, and this. But it can be, and I'm sure loads of people can relate to, you know, this whole idea of climate change. It's very overwhelming. So, like, how have you approached your sort of way of dealing with it and what you do?
A drink. No.
I mean, that's necessary, regardless of climate change.
I used to laugh, again, if you go back, I don't know, 3 years ago, I used to not laugh at eco-anxiety. I won't say that because I wouldn't laugh at anyone with that's, anxiety.
Yeah. Okay. But I was going to say, like, I didn't know that term. That's an official term, eco-anxiety.
Yeah, and it was, you know what? I learned about that in comedy before I even started doing what I'm doing now. And, you know, there were comedians talking about it. And I was kind of like, come on. Like, it's not about you. If you're going to talk about the planet, can we not talk about you? Like, I know you're struggling with it. Shit, we're all upset about it, but it's not about you. And the more I've dived back into nature and that industry now, I'm sat here going, there's not a day that goes by that I'm not thinking, oh, fucking hell, we're fucked. Yeah. And like, it genuinely, and again, another hippie phrase, but the nature for me and biodiversity and the planet is like a friend. And when it's treated badly, I feel like I would feel if a friend was treated shit. Like, so if I see someone just throw a cup on the floor, like a tin can on the floor, I'd be like, fuck you. Like, why would you do that? Like, and it's like a punch. I actually feel it. So when you see forest fires in Brazil annually, when you see extreme weather happening where it's not happened before, when we're getting 18 degrees Celsius in October in London, I start to get worried because it's not normal. I've never seen Hampstead Heath so green for late October. I've never seen that before. So when I'm starting to see these kind of things happen, I'm going, I should be doing more. I should be doing as much as I can. But like you said, I'm only one person. How much can I do? But I think words, although actions are important, words are also as important because, yeah, look, I'm vegan for the planet. That's why I went vegan, because I can afford to not eat meat. I can change my diet. I don't have any health issues that say I can't. So I thought that's something I can do. I don't need to reduce. I can cut it out. I refill all my plastic bottles in the house. So I refill, you know, washing up liquid, hand soap, detergents, all stuff like that, shower gels. Everything we buy is paper-based, toilet rolls all paper-based. It's all stuff like that. We try and cut down our waste. I grow wildflower on my window boxes for the insects. I tried to do so much, but I think your words sometimes are actually, and not your preachy words, they're just talking about it. I think that's one thing. If you're doing something, it could be, Steve, you've decided to buy oat milk instead of dairy milk. And if you just say to someone once, oh no, I do it, it's really nice, and actually I found out these benefits to it, it's really cool, and then that passes on to someone, and what happens is people start to change. I you know, every conversation I have with someone about the planet, the first thing I'll try and tell them is, what energy company are you with? Change it to a renewable energy one. That is the best fucking thing that everyone has the power to do, is to change their energy company. Because if everyone does that and there is enough energy for it, politicians will follow and start investing into those kind of energy companies. Because they're not, you know, there was a quote from the CEO from Good Energy who said that politicians aren't leaders, they're followers. They follow where the market goes.
Yeah.
So all we've got to do is get people over and they'll start investing into it. And they'll probably end up taxing it at some point. I don't know how, but they will.
That idea of, you know, changing consumer habits and behaviors, that goes across the board, doesn't it? I mean, yeah, energy companies is a great example, but it's, yeah, the power is with the consumers.
I believe so. And you know, a lot of people will go like, well, it's not up to us, it's up to the big corporations. And you're like, no, you're right. It is, you know, that, and that is where the big problems are. But don't underestimate the power that you have with your voting, with your voice, with your money, because, you know, capitalism involves you and I. It does, because we have money. So we pay into the system. So we have to be careful where our money is getting paid into. You know, look up a company before you sign up with them. If you've got your internet company or down to your pension, start looking up who's got your money. What are they investing it into? Are you happy with that? If you're not happy with it, change it. Change it to something. And I think the power to ask questions and the power to talk about it is one of the best things you can do. And just ask questions as well. Like, the thing is, like, no one gets it all right. I fuck up all the time. I end up doing something, they go, ah, shit, that should have gone in the other bin, or that's not compostable. But it's like, well, yeah, but then you learn from it, don't you? So I do always think, like, what could I be doing more?
On the subject then of eco-anxiety,
yeah, go on.
What do you do outside of your podcast and your work to relax and unwind and to find a sense of peace?
I walk my dog, or I just like well, I got a dog last year, rehomed a dog with my girlfriend, and she's the best. I mean, I know everyone listening with a dog is going to tell me shut up, but she's the best dog on the planet. Everyone's dog is the best dog on the planet.
Yeah,
she makes me really happy.
Yeah,
yeah,
Yeah, you know what happens? Yeah, you know what happens though, right? This is what I've noticed. So you start off, people get, couples get a dog, right? They get the dog because it's sort of like, it's good training. It's good to see, to work out whether you can, you know, you're viable as a couple to raise a child, to see how you get on well together, what tensions arise, et cetera. Then eventually that goes well, you go, all right, cool, well, this is all right. We should have a kid. Then the baby comes along and all the sort of, you know, all the love and, you know, how much you doted on this dog completely vanishes and it goes straight to the baby. And then the dog is just neglected. It just happens.
I agree. And
it's,
you know,
human
what?
Nature. It's human nature. Everything is like the shiny new thing. And then we're just, oh yeah, no, this is, oh, how cute, how lovely.
Mm. But that's why I think people should start with a cat.
Work the way up.
And then get a dog.
What about
and then
hamster?
See if they still care about the cat. Well, yeah, you could do multiple. Like
small,
dogs.
Just
you
scale.
Could just do loads, yeah.
Yeah.
And then still see if your first pet is alive. If you're still giving a shit about the stick insect you got when you're already on a horse, then have a kid because it'll be fine.
That should be the beta test, shouldn't it?
Yeah. Don't just do one, then kid. No, do three or four. Rescue out. Always rehome them. Rehome your stick insects, guys. Don't be buying new.
Okay, so having a dog, going for a walk.
Got my dog, Riley, and I love her to bits, and I'll take her for a walk. Obviously, there is just being immersed in nature and wildlife, so I'll go with no headphones, and I'll go with my camera. I bought a camera during lockdown, Christina, my girlfriend, got me a lovely macro lens, so close-up, so I can do close-up insect. I've really got into bee photography, Steve.
Have you?
I really like taking pictures of bees and flies and wasps. It's a really, once you dive into that world and you get closer into it, it's a really beautiful kind of, when you get a picture of them flying. I'll send you a picture. One of my pictures. I really enjoy it. You kind of like go, it's like being in a rainforest and it's like you get that nice picture. And I guess that's really relaxing because it's something you can do on your own. You don't have your headphones in. And just, I try to open up my senses more. So when I go for a walk, if I'm on, obviously the Hampstead Heath or Highgate Woods because it's near me, I open up my ears a bit more. I start listening and questioning what I'm hearing.
Okay.
And like, what is that bird? I keep hearing that bird again and again. So I'll record it and then I'll try and identify it and start learning. It's a nice path to start going down. So there's those two things. And I think the other thing, away from nature and stuff, I just try and, it's not forced happiness, but I try to feel the positive in as much situations. So if I am feeling anxious, stressed, or that's been a really horrible day, and also the fucking world's on fire. I mean, do you remember when we set fire to the ocean like 7 months ago? Do you remember when that happened?
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember that news article, the ocean suddenly set on fire and we're like, fuck me, what have we done? So that really hit me quite hard. I was like, what hope have we got if we can't even keep water from burning? Like, it's mad. I just find trying to laugh about the ridiculousness of the world just kind of makes me go, be okay. It's got to be all right. And then I'll spend time with Christina. We'll go on the narrow boat. We'll come back refreshed, recharge. I'm like, right, let's get a podcast out and let's have a good time. I think just putting yourself in that mindset of going, again, not forced happiness, but going, let's try and be happy today. Okay, as I took the bin bag out of the bin, it all split. But fuck me, that, like, if someone filmed that, that'd be funny. And just trying to learn, like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
If I was watching that on Twitter, I'd be laughing about it. So trying to find the funny in it, and it's fucking hard, but trying to do that really helps me as well, I think.
I think that's a really good point, though, that, you know, being happy requires effort. It's not something you just,
yeah.
You know, some people are just really lucky. You know, they're just born with this sort of like incredibly easygoing temperament where, you know, they're sort of just, everything's nice and easy and chill. It's like, fuck you. You know, where others.
And we hate those people.
Fucking hate them, you know. But, you know, at least we're trying our best, Ryan, aren't we? We're trying our best to be happy. And that's the main thing. But
I do
think.
Very few things you enjoy naturally, I think, don't you find?
Very few things.
Like, you have to always put in a bit of an effort to enjoy it. And you always have to be putting a bit of an effort to be sad about things as well sometimes. Like, if you go bowling and just stand there, like, this isn't fun. But if you go with a few friends and you try and you make that effort, that's where the joy and the positivity comes from. That's a weird example. But.
No, it's right. It's true. No, but just in terms of, so I'm doing this thing at the moment. I was seeing this CBT sleeping coach because I had insomnia. And so as part of it, I have to do this diary every night before I go to sleep. So ideally, you know, you're getting rid of all your anxieties before you go into bed. And so you have to, a part of you do it, you draw a smiley face and then a sad face. And on the smiley face, all the things that, you know, any positive things that have happened that day or anything that's made you happy. And then the same for any of the negative things. And then you review it in the morning. And then ideally you look at any of the patterns over the last few days. You go, oh, that, you know, reaching out to that friend or going out for lunch or, like you said, bowling or someone, that made me happy. I'm going to do that again. And then you repeat it. It's like putting in that effort. Because, you know, I 2 weeks could go by and I might not have seen anybody. And then suddenly I'm feeling like, oh, God. And I don't even know why. Yeah. And they go, oh, actually, I haven't seen anyone. I've been out of the house in 2 weeks.
Yeah. It's mad. Because that's the thing. I think that's what you've just hit on the nail on the head. It's recognizing what, not just what the problems are, but what the positives are. So, like, yes,
exactly.
Sometimes you can sit there and be like, everything's shit. Everything's fucking, like, the world's on fire. Government are fucked. COVID, loads of people have died. It's autumn now. There's not a lot of sun. And you can go down such a fucking dangerous hole with that. And you can still feel those things, but then also go, wait a minute. Or if I'm talking to myself, I go, wait a minute, Ryan. You've got a podcast that you're getting paid to do and you get to talk to amazing people. You run a dog daycare company and you get to work a really good working life balance and get paid to walk dogs on Hampstead Heath. Your girlfriend lives on a narrow boat, so every weekend you're on a canal just venturing around London. Your girlfriend's incredible. You got a dog and you get to chat to Steve for his podcast tonight. Everything's fine.
I was about to say I'm jealous of your life, but I couldn't. You're making me.
Do it for yourself.
Yeah, no, I was about to say you're making me jealous, but then I realized once you said that last line and you get to chat to Steve, it would have made me sound very egotistical. So I couldn't really say that line. Oh, mate, I'm so jealous you get to chat
to Steve. I can interview you in a minute if you want.
Yeah, we'll do that. Yeah, we can do that. Okay, so that's good. I've got a clear idea of what you do to, you know, relax and unwind. And there's some really lovely advice there. Are there any books that you've read in the course of your life, Ryan Dalton, that have inspired you in any way?
I was given a book when I was when I was working in the zoo. When was that? 2012, I think. When I was I wasn't a zookeeper at the time. I was working in the education department, and my manager, a really inspiring woman called Justine, she so cared about kind of delivering a message or an experience to public, which is what our job was in the zoo. And she gave me a book, and we would talk about Disney all the time. Like, we were big Disney fanatics, and we loved Disneyland, and we loved theming, and we liked being taken away from the real world and kind of like shown a different world. And you would forget where you were. You'd go on like the haunted house ride, and you'd actually think you're in a haunted house. We love that kind of shit. And she gave me a book called Lessons from the Mouse, which was by I think he was the operations director for Disney for 20 years, called Dennis Snow. And he kind of gave, not secrets, but he gave everything he learned for working as a management, working his way up in Disneyland, about how Disney are so good at capturing imagination and taking you away with that, about the detail that they go into. And there's little things that you don't even realize. You will never see a wet floor sign at a Disneyland, something like that. You'll never see one. You'll never see a delivery coming at Disneyland because it all happens underground. There's all this stuff where everything's so hidden. But what I liked about this book is it wasn't just like, this is how Disney do it. It was like, but this is the actual, you know, tricks and how you can put it into your work and your life to be positive. So it's kind of, it taught you how to separate things up, like you just said there about before going to bed, about the positive and the negative, and how to see the overlaps or to see the patterns and stuff like that to perform better going forward. And what I liked about this book is it slowed everything down, and especially at the time in my job that was such a fast-paced job, it made you go, wait, stop, let's journey back and let's correct some of these things that we're doing. So she gave me that book, and I must have read it 20 times over, I think, and I've given it to my brother since. And it was kind of inspirational to the point of going, there's lessons I'm learning here that I've got a feeling that in 20 years' time, I'm going to go, oh shit, yeah, I'm doing this because of that book. Yeah. But I might not have picked up on it at the time. It was really, really interesting. It would have worked a shit ton for comedy. I'm running comedy gigs. So many more comedy clubs could have taken lessons from that book.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to give that one a read. Final question for you. What does the idea of balance mean to you or not?
That's a really good question. I think balance is doing the things you love and being happy about it. I think it doesn't mean that you spend 50% of the time doing that and 50% of the time doing that. I think if you're living your life and you can write down the things you have and you're happy about that, then you've got a good balance. It doesn't matter how much time you spend at work. It doesn't matter how much time you spend with friends or family. It doesn't matter how much time you spend on your own or with people. A lot of people always say to me, but you can't be on your own, can you? You can't be introverted. And I can, but I don't like to be. And I don't think that's a problem. Because I have, that's my section of balance. If I can have 4% introvert time and 96% extrovert, then that's my balance and it doesn't matter. So I think really, as long as you've got the points in your life that you're happy with and write, I cannot stress enough, write them down, write what you have in your life. And if you're happy with how that's working and you feel joy most of the time, then you've got balance.
Love it. That's a great answer. Thank you. Where can people keep up to date with your what you're doing and your podcast? What's the best links and social media for you, Ryan?
I've tried to keep all my social media the same. So it's at Mr. Ryan J. Dalton on Twitter and Instagram. For the podcast, I on my own social media, I've got my Linktree account. So if you click on that, it will take you to the podcast, social media, and to the apps where you can listen to it. But my podcast is called Into the Wild, and it's Into the Wild Pod on Instagram and Into the Wild Podcast on Twitter. And again, the Linktree accounts are there to take you to wherever you listen to your podcast, take you to our website. And I hope your listeners listen to it because it's about nature. And I think sometimes we forget to enjoy listening about nature. It is shit out there, but also there's some fucking good stuff going on.
And I think what you do is you, no pun intended, but you strike a balance between being, you know, laid back, like you said, and a fun host. But also, you know, you're dissecting, you know, very sort of like deep subject matters, important subject matters in sort of bite-sized chunks that people can take away and feel like they're, you know, they're somewhat informed on what's going on out there.
Yeah, that's exactly what I try to leave no stone unturned. I'm like, well, if it's happening in the world, why shouldn't we talk about it? And let's, you know, try and do that in the most, again, balanced way we can.
Great. Ryan, mate, really great to catch up with you. And thanks
so much for coming
on the podcast.
Absolute pleasure, man. Take care of yourself. Perfect.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.